In this part of Focus 580, we will look back to an event in American history that will, I think, not be familiar to a lot of people listening. It was, as our guest says, for this morning, the largest armed uprising on American soil since the Civil War. It took place in 1921, when something like 10,000 West Virginia coal miners took up arms against the mine owners, and they fought a 10-day pitched battle against a combined force of police and militia. It was only after the federal government sent in troops did the miners give up. And it is a story that is both important for American labor history, but our guest this morning, Robert Shogan, makes the argument that it is, in a larger sense, an important story for American history and had a lot to do with shaping relations between labor and management for a long time. After that, perhaps even now. He tells this story in his recently published book, which is titled The Battle of Blair Mountain, The Story of America's Largest Labor Uprising. It's published by the West View Press. Our guest, Robert Shogan, for more than 30 years, covered American politics over the course of seven presidencies. He covered the political scene from Washington as national political correspondent for Newsweek and also for the Los Angeles Times. He is currently adjunct professor of government at the Center for the Study of American Government at Johns Hopkins University. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions are certainly welcome. The number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So wherever you are, whichever number works best for you, if you want to join the conversation, that's great. Again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. And any place else you might be listening, around Illinois, Indiana, actually even people, if you were listening on the internet, you may use the toll-free line as long as you're in the United States, and that is 800-222-9455. Mr. Shogan, hello.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
Fine. I'm glad to be back in Illinois electronically, anyhow, and in the Midwest.
Well, we're glad to have you talking with us this morning. And one of the reasons I thought that it would make an interesting conversation is that, first of all, I think probably most people don't have much labor history. Haven't gotten many of those stories as they've moved along through life and through school, and that this would be a story that a lot of people hadn't heard. And I guess maybe that's one place we could start out, and I could ask you why it is that that this story, as significant as it was, both as labor history and as American history, seems so little known.
Well, that's a question that, you know, maybe Michael Moore could answer, because he has a way of looking at the things. I think that that the reason it's been it's so little known, and this is true even in West Virginia, where people grow up being unaware of that, many of them, is that because Americans don't like to recognize certain realities about the country, and one of them is the jarring idea that we do have class conflict here, of one kind or another, that it's not just one big, happy, middle-class menage of people paying their mortgages and sending their living behind a white picket fence and sending kids off to school. It's a jungle out there, people say. And there's been conflict between workers and their bosses for a long time, and that continues today. At times, and in the past, it got to beyond conflict and reached the stage of outright warfare. What we had in West Virginia 80-some-odd years ago was a virtual civil war. And I think people, rather than talk about it or deal with it, people would just pretend it didn't happen. It's not that it was ignored at the time. It's important to realize that the major papers all over the country covered the story. Reporters came from everywhere to report on this war. They sent war correspondents, people who'd been in World War One, to cover the fighting. And it was page one news everywhere and in the newsreels. But very soon thereafter, it was just forgotten. Now, part was the immediate mood of the country. It was in the 1920s. It was the roaring 20s, and it was the good times were rolling, and Harding and Coolidge were in the White House. and the unions and labor were thought of as as really very minor elements, and so people just pretended that they weren't there. And then even later, when the labor movement revived, thanks to the New Deal and thanks to the Depression, people continued not to deal with it or not to pay attention to it. So it's not a deliberate, not an overt conspiracy, but it's sort of a subliminal one, I think, in which people just don't want to talk about things.
Yeah.
And one of the things I learned as a journalist in all those years was that sometimes the best stories were stories that people in power didn't want to discuss or let you know about. And so that's one of the reasons that made me go after this. I really started working on it 40 years ago, got sidetracked by a lot of things, and then wrote a lot of books about politics. And then when I retired a few years ago, I came back to this. Fortunately, I could still read my notes. So that made it possible for the book.
Well, the bottom line here, as you say, is around this period. So this we're talking about 1920, 1921.
Yeah.
It was a time of intense kind of strife between unions and people who were hoping to organize unions and the people who ran the companies that these people worked for.
That's right.
And so that is here the bottom line. That it was an intense period of labor strife. And for a lot of people, the bottom line simply was the right to organize. And that's here what people were fighting about in this little corner of West Virginia that borders on Kentucky. That is the desire of the miners to organize and of the mine owners to prevent that.
Yeah. Yeah, well, to put it in perspective a couple of ways, it was a transitional period. Well, World War One had just ended a couple of years before. World War One had been, a friend of mine Joe McCartan wrote a wonderful book called Labor's Great War, and it was a terrific war for labor in some extent because they were for the government in order to get a share of production in coal and a lot of other industries, took over. They didn't take over the companies, but they made sure that that there were labor strife was eliminated and labor was in short supply, so that management business had to go along with labor and their demands. And after the war, there was a struggle. Labor wanted to maintain that new role it established and strengthen it, and the corporations, big companies, wanted to wipe them out, and they did. There was no talk of getting along with labor, not in West Virginia particularly. People there just didn't think there ought to be unions. They thought they were un-American, they were creatures of Lenin and Trotsky, who were then ruling the Kremlin. So that was part of the reason. And West Virginia was very important because the United Mine Workers were one of the most, at that time, the most powerful union in the country. And they organized the mines well in Illinois and elsewhere in the Midwest, in Ohio and also in Pennsylvania, were very well organized. But in the southern West Virginia, they developed coal resources more recently. These mines had opened up during the war when they needed production, and they were not union. And the trouble with that is as long as they kept producing, it was very hard for the unions in the union mines to bargain successfully or to strike because there was enough non-union coal coming out of West Virginia to break the strike. So it was a critical period. It was a struggle to happen to take place in a corner of West Virginia, but what was involved was the strongest union in the country, United Mine Workers, and what was that time probably arguably the most important industry in the country, coal. That's what fueled the economy.
We have a caller here, somebody on a cell phone, so I want to bring them into the conversation,
good.
And let's do that. Line number one, right here. Hello.
Hi, good morning. Mm-hmm. What a fantastic topic to talk about. I want to point something out that you brought up earlier, which was why do people not have a sense of these kinds of battles that had taken place? And in a book written by a guy named James Lowen called Lies My Teacher Told Me, he talks about how textbooks shy away from any kind of controversy. Something like this that would be perfectly good topic for a textbook to cover isn't covered. And I just wondered if your guest had any primary sources in the writing of his book, people who had been involved, either family members involved in this coal war, or if and sort of what his primary sources were like and what his secondary sources were like. So those are my questions. Great topic. Thanks.
Okay.
Yeah, well, There aren't any living primary sources because it was too long ago. But there's some important source material. The leaders of the march were tried for treason against the state of West Virginia. It's kind of an improbable charge. And that's the transcripts of those trials are on microfilm, and I was able to gain access to them. In fact, I first started reading them 40 years ago. There's all kinds of testimony, not only from the strikers, from government officials and mine owners and nearly everyone involved. And so that was a big primary source. And then another source was the Senate of the United States, the Senate Labor Committee had hearings just before and then just after the march in the summer of 1921, and it went on for several weeks, with more than 1,000 pages of testimony. I was able to get a copy of that, fortunately, and just about anybody who had any connection with the strike was testifying. So that was a pretty good primary source material, because you had the miners, the leaders, you had the companies, and you had the give and play of politics. Another source material was a shootout which is related to the start of the book in the town of Matewan. I don't know how many listeners have seen the movie Matewan. Came out about 15 years ago, John Sayles production. And the movie focuses on that shootout. And anyhow, a guy named Sid Hatfield, who is the police chief of Matewan, who was very pro-labor, he and some of his cohorts were tried for murder. They shot and killed seven private detectives who were used by the coal companies to bust the union. And they were tried, and I was able to get transcripts of much of that testimony. So that, along with newspaper reports, was provided a good deal of material, and there was, you know, some secondary information that was helpful. And there's, a pretty complete bibliography at the back of the book. So I hope that would help you.
Yeah. Well, I know that there are a lot of resources, or at least some that I have come across on the internet, so people do have access. For example, I came across a website that's West Virginia Archives and History, and they have a page here on the Battle of Blair Mountain.
That's
and they
right.
list
yeah,
books
that,
and periodicals.
That's right. Yeah, I was helpful. That would help me getting started. It's not primary. And another good piece of material is the Army was very involved. It kept the declaring martial law, and federal troops kept going in and out of West Virginia. It was like Iraq for a while. And there's a very good history of the U.S. Army's role in civil disturbance. And they have, that furnished, that was very helpful in guiding me to deal with the Army's role, because there were a lot of political machinations involved, whether to send troops or not. It's interesting that the Republican President Hoover, Harding, was, you might have thought, well, he'd be very eager to send troops in to smash the strike and help out business, but he was reluctant to, because I think they realized in Washington that the government of West Virginia was so corrupt and it was owned lock, stock, and barrel, in fact, many parts of it by the mine owners, that it was just a messy picture, and they didn't want to say, that they just didn't want to get involved in it. But ultimately, with 10,000 men fighting, chaos threatening, Harding did send in troops. He sent in the troops, and it was spearheaded by a squadron of bombers. Regular U.S. Army, it was the Air Service then, it wasn't the Army, we didn't have an Air Force, but Air Service. The commander by General Mitchell, Billy Mitchell, the guy who was famous for sinking aircraft carriers and getting admirals, man. And he came down there. Mitchell at one point talked about using tactics against the miners that were sort of prefigured the Guernica in the Spanish Civil War, but it didn't come to that. In fact, there were no shots fired in anger by the miners, the Union Army, the Union Miners Army against the U.S. Army, or vice versa. The only violence was between the miners and this other group that consisted of state police and militia, and I think you said, and also a kind of vigilante group.
Mm-hmm. Well, we should go back because one of the precipitating events, I think, for the Blair Mountain, the Battle of Blair Mountain, were the series of events that took place in Matewan, actually going back to the year before, in 1920.
Yeah.
There was the shootout involving the Sid Hatfield, who was the chief of police in Matewan, and his deputy, and these thugs, these guys, enforcers who were hired by the coal company.
That's right. The
Baldwin Feltz detectives. And there was the shootout in 1920. And then later the next year, in the summer of 1921, I think that was when then the Sid Hatfield himself was killed.
Yeah, Hatfield was murdered by the detectives after the trial. He was acquitted, and that was hardly a surprise because the people in Mingo County where he lived were not going to convict him of anything, and. The head of the detective agency, a guy named Tom Phelps, was seeking revenge because among the seven detectives killed in the Matewan shootout were two of his brothers. And so he was gaining revenge. And what he did was, this was in, August 1st of 1921. And after Hatfield had come to Washington, I mentioned these Senate hearings. And Hatfield had come up there and to testify and he had been at this time he was nationally famous figure, and in fact the Mine Works Union made a movie out of him called Smiling Sid, but Hatfield was lured. This was after the hearings. They trumped up some murder charge against him in a county that the mine owners controlled, McDowell County, some distance from where he lived, and into the town of Welch. And Hatfield was apprehensive by going there, but he was given assurances that the local sheriff would protect him. Well, turned out when Hatfield got there, the local sheriff conveniently was out of town, and Hatfield, his wife, and a good friend of his were walking up the steps of the courthouse toward his arraignment, I guess it would have been, and he was shot down by the Baldwin Feltz detectives from ambush. And right after they did, they ran up and put a gun in his hand to make it look as if it had been a gun battle, and they fired bullets against the wall to add to that result. Of course, they were ultimately freed. They pleaded self-defense, and they weren't convicted. The miners, that was what really triggered the march. The miners were really, they'd been on strike for about a year. The companies had used all kinds of violence against them. They'd evicted them from their homes. They refused to bargain or negotiate. And here, their organizers were locked up. Most of them had been locked up in jail in Logan County, Wyoming. So miners, as the miners saw it, the Union miners saw that everything was against them. And they got together, and it wasn't a formal plan, but it was a lot of word of mouth. Nobody wrote this down, or if they destroyed it after, but about 10,000 of them. And then they began a march on Logan. The idea was to free the organizer from jail. And they also said, you know, we'll hang Don Chafin to a sour apple tree. That's what they say. Don Chafin was the sheriff of Logan County, and he was a figure who, well, he made about $3,500 a year, and he accumulated $350,000 in net worth, so you can give an idea of how he handled his affairs. But he was a shrewd guy, and they thought they needed to get him. I think their other purpose was to gain attention. I think they felt that if they could dramatize their cause and get the attention of the country, outside of West Virginia that people would realize what a great injustice this was, and they would get support. I think the important thing to remember about this is they were accused of treason because they were supposed to overthrow the government. They weren't trying to overthrow the system. They were trying to make the system work for them. They believed very strongly. Many of them had fought in World War One. They believed very strongly in America, in the Constitution. They had very little interest in socialism or communism. Afterward, the mine owners looked as high and low to get evidence of communist infiltration. There wasn't any. As soon as the soldiers marched in, they threw down their arms and they said, "We can't fight Uncle Sam." And they waved. They marched off waving the American flag. They felt they won some kind of victory because they thought, "Well, now people realize what a terrible thing this is, that we were so desperate. We were driven to this." But that's not what happened. People didn't seem to care. This was 1920s America. Well, we have indifference now, too. I think if I could say one other thing, I don't mean to ramble on too much, but, you know, you talked about this being labor history, and that's the way people refer to it. And, of course, literally you're right, but I guess that expression, I wonder about that a little bit. When we talk about labor history, it's a little hard for me to differentiate labor history from American history. You know, if you take the working people out of America, I don't know what you have left. You know, it's 275 million Americans, or so 250 million working people. What have you got left? You know, I guess people who send money to the Bush campaign, I don't know, but I think that labor is an integral, and working people are a pretty big part of this country. And although sometimes people don't like to realize it or look at it that way.
Well, we are at our midpoint here. Let me introduce again our guest. We're talking with Robert Shogan. He was for a long time a political reporter. He worked both for Newsweek and the Los Angeles Times, and he now is adjunct professor of government at the Center for Study of American Government at Johns Hopkins University, and is author of a book that explores this history that we've been here talking about. His book is titled The Battle of Blair Mountain, The Story of America's Largest Labor Uprising. It's published by the Westview Press and is out now if you'd like to look at it. Questions are certainly welcome, 333-9455. It's all free, 800-222-9455. We talked a little bit about the what happened in Matewan, and then as the revenge killing of Sid Hatfield that happened after that, then and the fact that the miners were what they were doing is they were marching to a particular county, this county Mingo, that's right on the border between West Virginia and Kentucky, that was a focus of organizing efforts. But to get there, they had to go through Logan County, which was...
No, they had to go through Mingo to get to Logan.
I'm sorry. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, they were...
Well, they had to cross Blair Mountain. That was the reason.
I guess did they not have to go through the county where Chafin was... Don Chafin was the sheriff?
No, yeah, that was Logan.
Yeah, and I'm just what?
Yeah, well, that's right. Yeah.
What happened when they went through Logan County?
Well, they didn't get through Logan County. They tried to, and they were stopped at Blair Mountain in order to get. So they were marching on Logan County, and when they got to Blair Mountain, that was a natural defense line for the companies because of I was just there recently, and it's a pretty high mountain being strip mined now, and there are people making a big effort to save it, preserve it, get it declared a historical site, to keep them being ripped apart by the coal companies. But at any rate, it was there that Chafin formed the defense line that consisted, as I mentioned, of the state police and militia. And that's where the fighting went on. I mean, it was a series of skirmishes, and it wasn't just one battle. It went on for quite some time and for a number of days. And it was getting to a point where it looked as if the miners were going to break through and just a Logan. And when that happened, of course that was very threatening to them. They would have been able to get the people out of jail and so on. And
yeah, so that would have been a great victory for
that's
union.
Right, for as long as it lasted. But yeah. We don't know how to do it. Yeah, you're right. I'm sorry, I misstated. They had to go, of course, Logan to get to Mingo County.
Yeah, that's. I guess that's what I thought. So,
you had that right.
But you're right that then the police and the authorities and the people are basically on the side of the mine owners. Yeah. They drew the line. They said, okay, this is where we're going to draw.
Cross Logan
you can't.
County, yeah,
right.
That's where they were in jail. Were in Mingo County.
Yeah, yeah. And so that and that's how it is that it ended up being this place.
Yeah,
Blair Mountain, where there was this big constant where there was literally an armed encampment of miners there, and people kept flowing into it, but they got kind of bottled up because the opposition was saying, okay, this is where you're not going to cross this line, and that's why it happened at this sort of as it did at that place.
Yeah, well, that's right. And all of this took place. There's a map in the book that shows it, and all of this, there are also some good pictures in the book, I think, of. We got from the West Virginia Library of all the characters of Hatfield and Tom Phelps and the other people taken at the time. It's kind of interesting. But the map shows very clearly what was involved. And this whole thing, Logan, Blair Mountain is about, an hour and a half, 2 hours from Charleston. I don't know if many people are in... the capital of, are familiar with West Virginia. Charleston's the capital, so it's pretty close to the main city there. And labor would have been pretty strong in the area around Charleston and north, so that was natural for them to be able to move there. Another interesting aspect to this, as I mentioned, the people in southern West Virginia are trying to preserve a Blair Mountain. As a historic site, and after I mentioned the treason trials. Now the trials were taken. The trials were moved to Jefferson County because it was out of the area. They got a change of renown. Jefferson County is in the West Virginia Panhandle, which happens to be near Washington, and one of the towns in the Panhandle is a town called Harper's Ferry, which is famous for history. Course, for John Brown's raid. Well, William Blizzard, who was ultimately designated as the leader of the march by the coal companies because they wanted to try somebody, William Blizzard was tried in the same for treason in the same courthouse as in 1922 that John Brown was tried for treason in, I guess it would have been 1857 or 1858, whenever he stays at raid. And he was, although Brown was treason against the United States, and the jail where Blizzard was held still standing. People in Charlestown, that's where the jail is, not to be confused, I hope, with Charleston. Charlestown, which is near Harper's Ferry in Charlestown, the city, the county fathers wanted to tear the jail down and put up a parking lot. And the people, local people there, are trying to preserve it because they think it's historically important. So, I mean, you have another example. You asked me at the beginning as to why people don't know about this, and when I think that people tend to disregard it. I was down there visiting, and I was interviewed by radio talk show person who said, why does this matter? I can see how this is important to labor history, but not American history. And, of course, I tried to say to him, as I mentioned earlier, that I think this is all part of American history. But anyhow, I was thought it was encouraging that there are people nowadays who not only want to know about this, but are trying to make sure that it doesn't vanish totally by saving the artifacts of it, the jailhouse in one case and the mountain where the battle took place.
Well, you talked a little bit earlier about the fact that one of the things that made the miners so angry was the murder of Sid Hatfield, who was the sheriff, and that he apparently was very sympathetic to the cause of the miners.
Yeah.
You talked about the fact that there are photographs in here, and here is a great photograph of some of the organizers from Mingo County, and in the photograph is indeed Sid Hatfield, and sitting next to him is none other than Mother Jones, the most dangerous woman in America. What made Sid Hatfield so sympathetic to the cause of the miners and the people who wanted to organize
them? Well, Hatfield's a bit of a puzzle. I mean, the miners thought he was a thug and everything. He had been a miner. He'd worked in the miners, and so his friends were miners. I don't think he had much use for the coal companies. I think he had belonged to the union, and he thought that was a good idea. And then as things sorted out, some of this had to do with local politics. He'd been appointed police chief by the mayor of Matewan, a man named the Cable Testament, and Testament was sympathetic to the union cause, and that was, he gave Hatfield's job, so Hatfield had, it was more reason than ever. There's an interesting sidelight to this story, a little bizarre, is Testament was one of the people killed, Cable Testament, was one of the people killed in the Matewan shootout, was sometimes called the Matewan Massacre. That was on May 19, 1920. Within a week of that shootout and his death, Hatfield, very short time, maybe longer than a week, Hatfield married his widow, Jessie Testament, who was considered a rather attractive young woman at the time. So there was a bit of scandal to it, and of course, Tom Fels, the detective agency chief, seized upon that. And at the trial, he claimed that Hatfield had instigated the whole shootout so he could kill Testament and marry his wife. Hatfield maintained, of course, that the detectives had shot Mayor Testament, not him, and his Testament's widow and had him, Jesse, Hatfield's new wife, she testified that, or she didn't testify, but she stated publicly that the Testament and Sid Hatfield were good friends before the shootout, and that her husband, Cable, had said to her that if anything ever happened to him, she should look to Sid Hatfield for friendship and support, which she did. Well, there you go. So you can believe what you think about that, but it doesn't change the main theme. I mean, these people were human beings, and this is a story. I mean, it's important in terms of laborist Americanism. It's also a very human story. You have every kind of human emotion and virtue and fault, and there was courage and greed and avarice and loyalty and betrayal. You had a whole bunch of characters on one side and another, because this was a matter of very literally of life and death for the people. And even before the battle, there was continual skirmishes and shootouts between the mine guards on one hand, and sometimes and state police, or more often it was the mine guards and the strikers who were firing away at them. So you had violence, a continual pattern of violence all through the state, and you had the governor who couldn't handle it, was trying to get federal troops, and the federal troops would come in, they would stay for a couple of weeks, and they would go out. So the period of violence lasted for 2-3 years. Now, Mother, you mentioned Mother Jones, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Now, she played an important role here. It was kind of an ambiguous role. She was very, I think most of your listeners probably know who she was. She was a very formidable labor organizer. Happened to be a woman. She was a school teacher, and she had, her husband died early during some epidemic, and she became a labor organizer. She was very effective. She took advantage. She was very good at dramatizing herself. She would have been terrific in this media age because she knew how to play to her role. She was a white-haired lady. She was a time this book went on in her 80s, and of course she used language that little old ladies weren't supposed to use then, or maybe even now, but she did anyhow, got away with it. She had been a big help for the miners, and it helped organize them. When it came to the march, she got old, and she became susceptible to flattery as a part of the governors, on the part of the Republican governor of the state. And when the miners were getting ready to march, she decided this was a mistake. Now, that was not a crazy thing to say or an unreasonable thing, because you could argue that, well, what were they going to do? They couldn't win. This was a battle they were ultimately going to lose, maybe. But you could make that argument. But she went beyond that. She told them that it was a big meeting the miners had just before the march got started. And she made a big speech in which she said, I have a telegram here from President Harding, which he promised that if you'll only go home and drop your guns, go home, that he'll look into this, take care of these things. Well, the union leaders were very suspicious that why Harding should send a telegram. She waved this piece of paper, and they said, well, let's see that telegram. And she said, well, I won't show it to you. Well, they didn't believe that. So they called the White House, and somehow, remarkably, they were able to get through, and they were told that, no, Harding had not sent any telegram to Mother Jones at all. So after that, they viewed this as kind of an act of betrayal on her part, and it was unfortunate because she had made a great contribution to labor. But as I said, there are all kinds of human emotions in this story, and this is one of them.
One of the pictures that's in the book here is at the end of the battle. And that apparently the soldiers collected arms and ammunition from both sides, and here's a picture of stacked boxes of ammunition and rifles, and in quite a few enough to looks like to outfit a small army, including a couple of machine guns, and it seems miraculous to me that more people weren't killed.
Well, that's right. There wasn't any. Well, first of all, we don't know how many people were killed. The estimates are 20 to 50. I've talked to people about that and been trying to understand it. I going down there helped me to understand a little. There's very thick growth there, a lot of foliage and trees. So there's a lot of good cover, and it's not the open territory. I mean, you could do a lot of shooting without hitting anybody. And I think although West Virginians like to pride themselves on being crack shots and all that, fact is that they were not, neither side were they organized or trained military forces. And I've never been in a battle myself, but I've read enough about it, and I suspect most of you listening have to know that there are moments of great confusion, chaos. That's what I've got from anybody I ever talked to. And this is true even when you have a fully organized, disciplined army. So I think there was a lot of confusion there with all the... The weapons, you're right, there was a tremendous amount of weapons, and they did make a tremendous amount of noise and gunfire, but fortunately, there weren't many more people killed than there were. There's one thing I wanted to say, if I could.
Sure.
I was struck writing this book. I really got into it right around the time of the 9/11, right after the attack on the Trade Center and the Pentagon. And things that happened in this country, I was reminded, and then researching the book again of the period then and now, there are some striking similarities. I mean, it was a period then of great unrest and concern about terrorism. As you people familiar with American history know, that there were bombs going off in Wall Street, and there were bombs sent through the mail killing people, and there was great fear because of the new Soviet government, and still relatively new in Russia, that they were going to perpetrate world revolution. So there was a kind of fear and terror of them, much as there is today of terrorism. And they were terrorists, some of the people, or they were believed to be. Some of the people in the United States were terrorists, and there was a great kind of suspicion of people, of aliens. People from abroad, it was great xenophobia, people were deported, and a lot of this reason is, so it's a similar period, And it made it hard for the labor movement then. I mean, that was an added problem because all their leaders were thought of as being linked to the Soviet Union or some kind of communist superior terror with that. And there were some strikes that they'd make that charge against UMW, but against some of the strikes that those charges were made. And just as, and there was an attempt to stifle dissent. And of course, that had started with the first World War. But even after the war ended, we had the Palmer raids. I think people have heard of A. Mitchell Palmer, the Attorney General, and he was Attorney General for a Democrat, and he was the John Ashcroft of his day, I'd say. And he raided all the people and accused them of doing this or that with never much evidence and deported them. So it was that was relevant to the. That the cause of the miners in West Virginia, because it made it harder for them to get public support, because there was so much fear that of the dangers that the country was faced. And I think when that happens, there's a tendency to be careless about protecting civil liberties and to let those things go, because there's supposed to be greater danger. Just as I feel, that's true today. And so I think there's another lesson there that goes beyond the labor movement, is that, you know, it's important. I don't mean to belittle that there is a terrorist threat to the country, but it's important to remember that, I think, that in protecting against that threat, just as it was important to remember in 1921 that not to abuse or undermine the freedoms and the values that we're supposedly trying to defend and protect. There's some contemporary significance to it. And I think it's particularly true today. This is not a good time for the labor movement. They really have been on the defensive, badly beaten. I think when President Reagan died a few weeks ago and we were exposed to this endless series of eulogies, panegyrics, when I remember somebody was talking about the PATCO strike, if you your listeners remember, that he broke the air traffic controller strike. He fired all the air traffic, broke the union, and it was a powerful blow against labor. It was about 20 years ago. And pundit, I was hearing, Daniel Yergin, who was a pretty renowned scholar, he said this is one of the reasons for our prosperity today. Well, I don't know, prosperity for whom, you know. But so these are times that the labor union is very much up against it, and progressive forces in general are. And I think it's important to remember at that time that when there was another period like that, that people were willing to stand up for their rights, what they took to be the right and what they believed. They risked very literally their own lives, and some of them lost them. And they were defeated, at least at the time. Now, decade later, or more than a decade later, they won most of the things that they had fought for in the 20s, thanks to the New Deal and to progress there. But the question is, if they hadn't fought for it, then would they have ever gained? And that's something that people have to decide. There are no guarantees in this case. You do what you believe in. But, again, that's why I think this is an important story, because our country has been shaped by struggles like this between various groups, and sometimes often between the haves and the have-nots. And the best thing about our country is that normally these things can be settled peacefully, and you go to court or in elections or one thing. But there have been times when, for one reason or another, business or government becomes so arbitrary or powerful that people are left with little recourse. And that was what the people in Blair Mountain faced, and that's why they did what they did.
We have about 10 minutes left, a little bit less than that, in this part of Focus 580. And our guest is Robert Shogan, more than 30 years covering Washington politics. He was national political correspondent for Newsweek and the Los Angeles Times, and currently he is adjunct professor of government at Center for Study of American Government at Johns Hopkins University. And his book, if you'd like to read it, is titled The Battle of Blair Mountain, The Story of America's Largest Labor Uprising, published by the Westview Press. staying, sort of getting back to the idea that this, in part, this is obviously, this is labor history. This is American labor history. I wonder, do you think that, you know, even though we're talking about here a series of events that took place in the 20s, so it's going back before World War II, that this has shaped relations between labor and management even now?
Well, I think it's emblematic of the kind of thing, not just by itself, but I think that the relations between labor and management are, you know, based on a series of conflicts and struggles back and forth. This is certainly one of the things that the coal miners, the mine owners got their way at that time, but the union kept fighting and kept waiting. So you have this tension and conflict that continues to go on, and there's not, and although there's we have bargains and contracts and success, there's a certain amount, there's a kind of a natural antagonism on both sides. And I think what was demonstrated in West Virginia, and I think that to today, is that the management realizes that when they have the power on their side, they will use it to the maximum. And that the lesson that the unions, labor people, have learned from it, it's a lesson they sometimes have to relearn, that at some point, although they can bargain and negotiate, sometimes there's not much room that they have to resist, and they have to be realized that in the long run, these companies are not looking out for their welfare, they're looking out for their stockholders or for their own profits. And I think that that's part of the, one of the attitudes that pervasive in today in labor management. Mm.
We talked a little bit earlier about the battle and about the fact that over this 10-day period there were a lot of skirmishes and they were fighting back and forth between the miners and those people who were opposing them, which was this kind of group of police and state police and militia and vigilantes. All these people sort of banded together, and that what finally brought the fighting to an end was the federal government sent troops led by Billy Mitchell, and that they actually were some airplanes used.
That's right.
That obviously that at that point the miners felt that they were so outnumbered they had no choice but to give up.
Yeah.
Was the in Washington was the that decision to intervene in that way militarily, was that at all controversial? What was the debate like about that?
Well, I think the argument was The important figure in the debate, in that discussion, was a guy named General Banholtz, who was sent to West Virginia by Harding as his emissary. Originally, when the governor first sought, Governor Morgan, the Republican governor, sought help. And instead of sending the troops immediately, Harding sent Banholtz to look over the situation. Banholtz's first inclination was to avoid using troops because that's the last thing he wanted. Banholtz was an unusual guy. He had been U.S. Emissary to Hungary after World War One. He was I'd been Hungary was a defeated country, and he was such a popular figure and so fair and so thoughtful that they erected a statue to him after he left. Anyways, Banholtz tried to negotiate, and he got the union leaders to agree to go around and tell the miners to go home. This was before the fighting started. They were marching, but he got them to persuade them to go home. And he said, you know, if you don't do this, he said, they're going to be crushed by the troops. So Banholtz got them to do that, and they started back. And then the local authorities, not the miners, broke the truce. They didn't really want the truce. They wanted the strike to be crushed. And so even as the unions were broken back, they violated the truce. The local police or state police friendly to the coal companies. And so then the once the miners found out about that, they went back to Agra. At that point, Banholz told Harding that he had to send in troops, that there was no other way, and he was very he condemned the coal companies and the governor for their behavior, the governor particularly for his behavior, for not living up to agreements and for causing this outbreak.
Well, we, you know, pardon me for jumping in on you there, but, you know, we've come to the end of the time and we're going to have to stop. There's more to the story, and people want to read more about it. They can look for the book that we've mentioned. It's titled The Battle of Blair Mountain, The Story of America's Largest Labor Uprising, published by Westview Press.
You can get it at Amazon.com or your local bookstore.
All right. Mr. Shogan, I want to thank you very much for talking with us today.
Well, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
We appreciate it. Robert Shogan.
You.